Welcome, everybody, back to the Reflex Blue Show at 36point.com. I am your host, Donovan Beery, and I brought co-host Ben Luters with me.
Hello, everybody.
We're still stuck in Boston for what seems like now forever. It's been weeks.
Hellish.
Weeks. And today we have with us Chris Chapman. Chris, how you doing?
Doing good. Glad to be here, guys.
And Chris, you are the Global Creativity and Innovation Director at Creative Inc.?
Yes, Creative Inc. Disney Creative Inc. Yeah, that's what we're called.
Okay, because your card's like Creative Inc. It says Disney Destination.
Yeah, it's all, you know how it is, internal speak. It's like the order of it and all. But yeah, it's Disney Creative Inc., so we're the internal kind of creative consultants for the Walt Disney Company.
It's also copyright Disney on your business card.
Can you believe that?
Is that a corporate thing where you actually
Absolutely. Anytime we ever put any type of image of Mickey or any of those things on there, there's always going to be a circle C of some kind. Just make sure it's also proven that it's legit.
Okay. And I know that how much work you guys have to deal with that, with the copyright, mouse, because didn't they even have to change the law a few years ago on the years
the
of copyright? They called it like the Mickey Mouse rule or something?
I'm not truly familiar with that, but I just know the law of protection goes from, like, if you look at the history of Walt, back in the days of him, he had this Oswald the Lucky Rabbit.
Right.
And, you know, he basically had that through unfortunate circumstances of not taking care of his, you know, intellectual properties. It was basically just grabbed from him, and all his artists were taken along with him. So ever since then, when he had created Mickey, he made sure that he was just protecting him, and that kind of just kind of lived on. Just make sure you're always watching out for his back so people don't, you know, go off charts with him.
How much of your day is just dealing with the copyright of the mouse?
Not much. Okay. I mean, we do most of the stuff we do is dealing with we take people through the creative process and stuff, and whatever we do, we deal with it in a collaborative way to help prevent it being a lot of interference. A lot of people, when they work with legal or copyright and issues, all that stuff, it usually becomes this thing where they get it checked last minute, or they pass it off to somebody and then they pass it back and they tell them what they can't do instead of working with them to find out what they can do. So if something comes up and, like, there might be something that's, you know, not working with the legal department, they'll say, oh, can we do this? Well, you're looking for a yes or no answer. But if you ask how can we do this, they're going to help you find a solution. So that's a lot of times we do it that way.
That's fantastic. Now, the first question we should probably ask you is, Disney Destinations, mm-hmm. is the part you're in charge of?
Disney Destinations is just it's part of the group that we're embedded in, which, I mean, nobody outside of Disney would even understand. The big picture is we're our group. We're internally, that's the group that we're embedded with. That's our, basically, we say where our paycheck comes from, and we're the hierarchy of where we're reporting through.
Yes.
We work for the entire company, helping them through the creative problem-solving process, inspiring them, teaching them on how to be more creative and more collaborative, leading people through brainstorms, through strategy, through research, complete innovation projects, speaking engagements, fixing workspace, like working with architects to, like, actually tear out locations and make them more inspiring and collaborative along those lines. So,
and are you dealing with, like, the movies, the toys, and the theme parks, the whole thing?
We work with ABC, just did a project with the Muppets, with Disney Animation Studios, with Pixar, work with our consumer product division, with our Disney Interactive division, the theme parks, you name it. So it's all across the whole board.
So, Chris, I gotta ask, how did you get this job?
Yeah, it was an interesting journey. So
he was just dressed as Goofy at the theme park.
Exactly,
that was his job. He was one of the mascots.
Actually got my start when I was in college working in the theme parks. I drove Kilimanjaro Safaris, worked at Kali River Rapids and Animal Kingdom, at Disney Animal Kingdom, all these different things, you know, in park. But I did internships and started networking with people within the creative field there and within design and some of those other areas. And as that kind of progressed, I did an internship within marketing for a little bit after school, and then got picked up by a group called Disney Design Group and Disney Theme Park Merchandise, and started designing global merchandise and some print stuff and logos and everything from toys, candies, to t-shirts, to hats, to games, to high-end stuff for adults, to things for kids. And even, like, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Disney Vinylmation, which was really fun. Worked on a team that started that up.
What is the Disney Vinylmation?
Vinylmation, it's a vinyl collectible. So we had we started a vinyl collectible series using Mickey, and it's branched out to many other things, Mickey being kind of like the blank canvas. And as we developed that, it kind of branched out. So we both had internal artists at Disney working on it, but we'd also send it out to other artists and inviting some guest artists to work on it. It's really kind of branched out. So it started as kind of this little underground thing, kind of grew, and we're still trying to keep it. There's some stuff that gets a little more mainstream and stuff we keep a little more under the radar.
And I assume the Vinylmation is one of those slightly more under the radar than completely out there. because it's more of a niche market?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where does somebody go to find these things?
Oh, you can if you just look up Vinylmation online, you'll find tons of pictures of them. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds. Disney Store actually picked them up after theme parks did it. There's exclusive ones you only can get at the theme parks in some areas like that. So as we progressed doing that, I worked on Vinylmation and finally kind of started getting a little frustrated as a creative and started reworking the process with leadership on how we could be more collaborative and merchandise for theme parks. And then I had gotten asked to go to give a presentation to this Disney Creative Inc. group, and they liked it a lot, so I kind of got recruited into that position. And then I was living in Orlando at the time, and they moved me out to Los Angeles, so I'm based up in Glendale and Burbank, and I've been to that position for a little over a year and a half. And
congratulations.
Yeah, it's been good. So now working through the creative process with everybody and leading these kind of ideation and innovation projects and basically trying to apply design thinking principles as from a design side to the process of creativity and innovation within the company. So it's a really cool gig.
Now, Disney's slightly different than some companies because when it comes to, when I say like, well, how many creatives do you work with? Well, there's obviously the entire animation team and stuff that would be creative. But as far as like the design team, the graphic design team that you work with, how big is the in-house department?
Designers at Disney, there's thousands. I mean, thousands. There's so many different divisions with different design teams. Disney Design Group is about 50 people for theme park merchandise. You look at Walt Disney Imagineering, you've got hundreds. And then you look at ones for Disney Interactive doing iPad games. They created the Where's Your Water game, if you've ever seen that. There's hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds. The cool thing at Disney, though, is because we're a creative company, even though we have, like, in my old philosophy was, like, you have creatives, which are the designers or are the architects and are the we take an approach of being very collaborative, and we're trying to focus on that because anybody can be creative. It's just people have different skill sets, right? So if you look at, like, a Major League Baseball player compared to a Little League player, they both can play baseball, but at two totally different levels. So we're trying to elevate and combine people to be creative because creativity, it's innate. It's in everybody, right? Anybody can create something. It's just people have a sharper focus in different areas. So we try to pull together everybody and let people have respective positions. So you're not going to have somebody in finance making a design decision, but it doesn't mean they can't help contribute to finding a solution or know some of the hurdles coming up to work together. And that's the way Steve Jobs works, the way IKEA works, and Target. You get, and I know Fossil does, you combine people at the earliest stages so you're not showing somebody in the last back end. You're throwing Band-Aids on to fix it because the timeline, the budget's like getting this close to deliverabilities.
Does it help that there's so many creatives there that they, does it help in the fact that do they possibly relate more and understand more about what you personally bring to the table? Or do they think that because they're creative could probably do your job?
No, that could be a hurdle sometimes. I mean, I used to be the same way. I hated somebody come in and tell me how to be creative. And a lot of times we go in and we're very honest about that. We don't ever try to have people say, hey, we're trying to tell you how to. We're trying to take the pressure off of them so they can be creative when you're doing collaboration instead of having to lead it themselves. So they can kind of go into creative mode instead of having to think about, okay, I have to pull together these people, I have to have this talk, make sure this is going throughout the day. And we work with a lot of the science of creativity, like getting people out of the office, being in natural light environments, setting up boundaries and rules and things like that for how you're going to brainstorm.
When you go out of the office, is it always to Disneyland?
Sometimes we do, sometimes. But a lot of times, just getting people, even if they have a great work environment, we like to get them inspired. So we actually had one brainstorm that somebody had helped us with, and we actually had the brainstorm in the middle of a street. And there's a dining area in the middle of the street.
Oh, wow.
Traffic all around. Everybody's just, like, talking. It's, like, this really weird, funky. I've had brainstorms in graveyards. We've had brainstorms out in the middle of fields. We've had brainstorms in old vaudeville theaters. I mean, just anything. Because environment, is that we're designers and we're tapped into emotion. And anywhere you can elevate people's emotions and get them not to think about work helps to get them into, like, a fresher thinking mode. And you're more relaxed. That's why some of the best ideas come while you're, like, drinking or hanging out over a dinner. It doesn't happen while you're sitting at a desk talking on a phone, right? Mm-hmm.
I like this.
You got to get out. And the more you're out, the more inspired you are, and the more the ideas start flowing. So
that's wonderful. Now, when you go to Disneyland, does it feel like work?
It did when I was working in the park on occasion. You'd go and you'd have to shut that off. And I've gotten to the point now where I can completely shut it off and just get into that suspension of disbelief where you feel like you're in a totally different country.
Yeah, I mean, it's the happiest place on earth. You should be happy there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when I go, I actually can. I can totally just enjoy it now. It doesn't feel like work at all because you get lost in it. You're going through a story. Once you get into the story, there's no way you can think about work.
When you leave, you're like, does it flash back and you're like, oh, I should... Maybe we should fix that.
Sometimes I'll look at things with an eye where I could think about, I wonder if we could do this differently, or I wonder how we could improve that. one of my favorite things, like Walt said about Disneyland and the parks in general, is that it's never going to be finished. We're always improving, always building on it, always adding. And that's always really exciting. Like Cars Land, we just added Cars Land to Disney California Adventure.
Oh, I saw that on the Ellen show.
It's amazing, man. If you check it out, it's like Radiator Springs is absolutely brilliant. I mean, you've seen the movie Cars, you know, Cars 2.
I have not seen Cars 2 yet.
It is Radiator Springs, though. Like, you go there, you
it looks like the movie.
I mean, everything down to the – I mean, it is absolutely brilliant. So we've got that, and then Magic Kingdom in Orlando at Walt Disney World, where we're getting ready to open up the Fantasyland expansion, where you'll be able to dine at, like, the Be Our Guest show, and from the movie actually be in it, you know, have go through the Little Mermaid's adventure and see what she'd been through and see the Eric's castle. And it's just, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It's pretty cool stuff.
What's your favorite of the parks that you have? Is it
Epcot, hands down?
That's the Orlando one, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's awesome. I'm big on travel and world travel, and you have all these countries, and everybody who works there, the chefs, the people are all from each country. So you can go around, drink and eat and try new things and shop, and it's like having a passport and just going around. It's such a massive, beautiful park, the architecture, and it's also got, it's almost like it's a permanent world's fair, so you also have, like, science and technology being showcased. So all the newest technologies are being shown. You can actually hands-on use them and try them out, and it's pretty cool. I love that park.
I've never been. This sounds
fun. I've been to Disneyland. I've not been to Epcot.
Oh, you've got to go. Epcot, like, Epcot's part of the bigger Walt Disney World resorts. So you have Magic Kingdom, which is like Disneyland Park, but different. And then you have Epcot, Disney Hollywood Studios, and then you also have Disney Animal Kingdom, which is awesome.
What's the one in Tokyo?
Yeah, Disney Tokyo. Although there's Tokyo Sea, right?
Okay.
Disney Tokyo Sea, and then there's Disneyland or Tokyo Disneyland.
My parents went there when I was a baby,
yeah.
So I don't remember it.
Also amazing. And then we have the Hong Kong Park, and we also have Disneyland Paris. So
fascinating.
And then we're opening one in Shanghai coming up, so it's going to be pretty cool. But yeah,
Ben, you got to check them all out next week.
After.
All
right, let's go.
Business expense.
Yeah, right.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back with Chris Chapman. Chris, since we are here at HAL Boston, I got to ask you, what are you talking about this year at HAL?
This year, I am talking about storytelling for designers and unicorns.
I saw that coming.
Do you guys have unicorns at the park?
No, actually, but in my backyard, personally, I actually raised unicorns from a young age, and then actually sell them off to blind elves that need them for, you know, kind of like seeing eye dogs, but they're seeing eye unicorns. So
it's a
fascinating situation, but. I have a license for it. It's been a very, very fun business.
It's good to hear you got a license for it. A lot of people joke around about that stuff.
It's a very serious matter. Absolutely. You have to be very careful with that stuff.
Unicorn mills are like puppy mills. You don't want.
No, you don't. Absolutely. There's always regulations, you know.
That's right.
You have to be very careful with that stuff. But actually, the feed's pretty expensive, but I'll tell you about that later. Yeah. The coolest thing about this presentation, basically, I'm at Disney World Entertainment, right? That's our thing, is family entertainment. And when it comes down to it, storytelling has been ingrained from the very beginning of Walt, moving forward all the way up to now. And you see it in our movies, you see it in our theme parks. And storytelling's always been a big part of my life. So as a designer, I've always noticed I lent myself to storytelling and understand the background of things and why. You know, as a designer, you're always asking, why are you doing this? Why do you choose that typeface? Why do you choose that paper to try to communicate something? Well, storytelling is communication, and we do it visually as designers. So I wanted to kind of show what we do at Disney, what I've done, what my belief is, what my passion, my research, and what I've learned about storytelling, and explain that, how designers can use that. Because today you hear people saying, well, we want to tell the right story across multiple platforms. You know, if we're going to have a website and a brand for this, and then also throw it on an iPod and all that, an iPad rather, and you know, an iPhone or any other digital devices, how do you tell a consistent story all the way across it? And, so the big thing is trying to understand how you come up with your story and let that overarching story inform all the decisions you make on any other platform or media that you might use.
So, Chris, what are some stories that have been very formational to you? You say mm-hmm. stories have always been a part of
yeah.
who you are. So.
One of the biggest things, I had a teacher in fifth grade, Ms. Collins. She was Scottish.
Where did you go to school?
When I was in school in fifth grade, I went to a place called Marion Jordan, just outside of Chicago.
Got it.
And whenever she was Scottish, like, you know, grew up in Scotland, whenever it rained or if it was cloudy, class stopped, and she would just go. We'd all go sit by the window, and she would tell us stories from Scotland. And I remember just being like, so sucked in. I mean, I'm very visual, and usually I love to have pictures, you know, but you didn't need them with her. The way she told these things, they just like were so vivid.
And it was the accent, wasn't it?
But the story's like Scottish had like, you know, part of my, the theory I think is, you know, it's such a cold place, right? For most of the year, it's beautiful if you ever get a chance to visit. But when they tell stories, you're obviously being indoors and you don't have things to do, and people would tell stories, and they've passed that heritage down. And the stories are so rich, and there are a lot of mythologies and the reason things happen. They have these things with these fairies and these things called the Brunies, and it's absolutely amazing. So that inspired me big time. I started doing a lot more writing. I always liked writing and telling stories, and I always loved, you know, movies are a big part of my life, and TV, and always enjoyed going to plays and theater, and my parents always did that type of stuff. My dad always told stories, so it's like that became a very big part of my life. So love stories. And old-time radio is another big thing. My dad had me grow up in some old-time
radio. Shadow.
Dude, the Shadow Knows.
The Shadow Knows.
Absolutely that, and like Life with Riley, and, you know, there's all these great things. Dial M for Murder. So all those different programs, you know, if you look at radio is some of the best storytelling because there's nothing visual. And so they had to go the extra mile to really communicate things. And sometimes you see that gets lost in some movie making where they lose the thread or compassion that's in the storytelling.
So how much story do you actually do now, like at your job?
Daily. I mean, everything's driven by story. We always ask, what is the story? You know, when we're doing any type of project, even if you're doing something, when I'm working with the advertising groups, like, you know, and they're trying to put out something in a different way, that we ask, you know, what is the story we're trying to tell here? How is that trying to be communicated? And that's always a very, very important part to what we do. Questioning the story, what's the motive behind the characters used in it? I mean, we're a character-based company, too. We have a lot of characters, so...
Wait, Disney?
Yeah, right?
Well, you guys just purchased Marvel, even, correct?
Yes, Marvel's a big part of us.
You get to work with the Marvel stuff?
That's just starting to get ironed out more because, no pun intended. but that's just starting to get kind of, you know, pulled together because once they became a part of our company, and now all the divisions are coming in, obviously we just had Avengers come out. And all these other projects are starting to develop, and they're starting to pull that together. But I haven't had direct development with them yet, no.
So, Chris, a lot of our listeners are students, design students.
Right.
And let's face it, you have, like, the coolest job ever. You have to admit it, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It's a pretty cool job. Absolutely. You work for Disney, yep. Storytelling, all this awesome stuff. You just said Avengers a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
So... what advice would you have for some of our listeners, some design students, and like
absolutely
how to follow their dreams? And
the biggest thing is, it sounds so cliche to say it, but
say it.
Follow your passion. And if you don't, you're going to know it in your gut. If you are following your passion and doing what you love. So let's say you're enjoying graphic design. You love it, right? Don't just say, okay, just because I do graphic design, I'm going to love my job. What would you love to do within graphic design? So if you love snowboarding, go work for Burton and do graphic design for Burton, create snowboards, or work for their print magazine. Because if you're combining those passions, you know, you're going to really live in a great place. I remember seeing Stefan Sagmeister do a presentation. He talked about the three types of things you can have in your life when you're working. If you go and you have a job, you're going to look forward to Friday, right? And you're going to pretty much, you know, watch the clock all the time and be waiting to get out of work. If you have a career, and work is just for making money, right? If you have a career, you're probably going to be looking forward to Friday. You won't look at the clock as much. You're going to make money, and you probably went to school for it. And you enjoy it, but there's still, you know, you're not fulfilled completely, and you get frustrated, and you think you're going to have this feeling always that there's something more, that you can prove it. A calling is where you love it so much that you lose track of time. You look at the clock, it's 2 a.m. You know, it's Saturday and you feel like going to work on a project because you're so excited. You can't wait for the morning to start because you're like, oh, I can't wait to work on this. And granted, that won't be like every single 100% of the time, but it should be majority of the time. So don't lie to yourself and follow what you absolutely love to do. And it's hard to think about it because you almost can fool yourself. You can be like, oh, if I had $1 million, what would I be, or $1 billion, what would I be doing for a living? Really think about what you would do if you were told you can have $1 billion right now.
It's not about the money.
Yeah, and you'd have the money. Now you don't need money. But the only way you can have that $1 billion kept in your bank account is if you work for the rest of your life, right? But you only have to, like, and so what job would you do, you know, in order to do that? And really think that over hard. And when you do that, you stop and start thinking like, you're only talking to yourself. You don't talk to anybody else about this because then you have to be brutally honest with yourself. And once you do that, you figure out where your passion is and what you love doing, what makes you feel good, and what, you know, and anytime anybody's working on projects they love and they have passion about, that's when the best work is always done because they care about it so much that it isn't work anymore.
Did you specifically hunt out Disney and try to get a job at Disney, or were you just looking at anything?
No, I knew the steps I was going to take. I talked to my dad about it, and that's why my first step in the door was doing that internship where I worked in the parks, and I knew that was the first step in the door, you know, in the door, and then networking like crazy, and then trying for the professional internship, and just it was all connecting all these dots along the way, knowing that I wanted to work there, and just constantly, you know, setting goals.
You mentioned your dad a couple of times.
Yeah.
What did your dad do, and how big of an influence did he have on your life?
Absolutely massive. He was so he always told stories. Every time he would improv stories when I went to bed. I never knew that. I always thought these were like, you know, and he would sit there and he'd tell my sister and myself stories. Ones I remember the most was about Flipper. If you remember the old dolphin story, he put us in the story.
Faster than
lightning.
Tell
it, yes. And so there was combination of that, the old time radio, and he loved movies, and we would talk about them, go see them. He actually did some projects at Walt Disney Imagineering, and he's always been a storyteller. He did a lot of what back then they used to call like multimedia and visual communication stuff, and used to throw special events for companies and do training and create videos and graphic design and photography, and all those things influenced me because I used to go to his conventions and watch these things done with like slide back when they're doing slideshows, right? They didn't have, you know, PowerPoints and projectors like that, so everything
slides
was done.
Are the wave of the future.
Oh, man,
how old are you?
I'm 32. This is back. I used to go when I was like 5. I'd sit there and just be like, wow. And I remember seeing it, and there's always they were telling stories. And it's a big part of what his business was. He's also a photographer, and he was an architectural student. So, but he always talked about stuff in stories.
Let me back up. What did your dad not do?
Yeah, right.
Your dad seems
pretty
amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. He was just always into art. Like my grandfather before that was a photographer, and both of them really in love with theater and old time radio. And so that kind of just like the storytelling just became a big part of my life. Mm. Yeah,
that's really good to hear. I mean, you know, my father's very, you know, formational in who I became, and
yeah,
obviously his support and stuff. So it's just neat to hear that kind of family connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Big driver for sure.
When you look out the window, do you still, and it's raining, do you think of Scotland?
You know, funny enough, whenever, if I'm indoors and I hear thunder, it makes me think of being in school and her being like, all right, let's go, you know, tell a story. So it's just like, I got to tell you, the thing is, what I found fascinating was, she could have done it for any other reason or just said it every Friday for, you know, 20 minutes. But it was so special because when that rain came, and she did some of the storytelling. She'd take us out. There's a forest right next to it, and a big open area where students would go and, you know, they'd have an outdoor class every once in a while. But I'll never forget just when that happened, it was like you'd be waiting for her to say it. And if the lightning got loud enough, there was enough rain, then she'd be like, okay, we got to tell the stories. And we'd go over there, and she'd shut the lights off. That was like when it went off, you knew.
This is so magical.
That's the thing is she knew how to create the environment. And there's something about the rain and the thunder, and it was like – and that's why, you know, everybody talks about love. There's great movies for watching rainy day movies.
Yeah.
Like Goonies is I don't care how many times I've seen it. On a rainy day, Goonies is an awesome movie to watch, right?
The rain just makes it better.
It does. Because you're like, I don't need to see outside, you know, get like, turn the lights on, pop popcorn, get junk food. And yeah, just, it always reminded me of needing to make the time to do that. And even when as an adult, when the lightning comes up, it makes me stop and say, I stop work and I'll go talk to somebody and be like, well, let's just do something right now. And then we might just like, come up with ideas together about anything random or just, you know, it's inspirational. So
what's your let's go back to Disneyland.
Yeah.
Epcot. What's your favorite ride
at Epcot specifically, or all the Disney parks as a whole?
All the Disney parks as a whole.
This is like asking what's your favorite kid.
What is your favorite kid?
Oh, let's see. I'm going to go with
what do
this.
You have a what do you have the most personal
the
passion?
The most personal passion.
Like maybe
there's
first,
kind of a, there's kind of like a trifecta.
Okay, we'll go with that.
Maybe a quadfecta.
You guys got a lot of rides.
We'll yeah, so we're going to go with number one that influenced me as a kid when I was about 4 years old was either Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, where you actually got to hold onto the steering wheel and you're driving through the attraction, and like you're always by yourself. It was designed so you always were in compartmentalized by yourself, and the story was wrapped around you. There's a part where you go down train tracks and you're bouncing. There's a train coming. And I remember that scaring the crap out of me. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where you're in the submarine and Captain Nemo's talking. I don't know if you've ever seen the Disney movie that Walt did, but it's this beautiful, you know, Art Deco, you know, submarine. You go underwater. I mean, you're down there and the water's pounding. You get deeper and it gets dark and you see, like, you know, killer whale with this massive squid wrapped around it and mermaids swimming around and lost cities of Atlantis. That, I mean, you were underwater. I remember they had this cold air blowing out and my dad's like, oh, that's the oxygen. I'm like, because you think you're underwater as a kid, right? And so it was, and you're looking out this porthole of glass underwater. I mean, amazing. And then The other one that I absolutely love is there's one at Epcot that's called The American Adventure, and it is storytelling at its best. You're in this massive theater. It's the pavilion representing America, and they go through, and Benjamin Franklin and Mark Twain host it. And they're audio animatronics, but they're so realistic up there. I mean, he's like creaking. You can hear he's smoking a cigar, and the smoke slowly coming out, and they tell the story of America in a very honest way, but you get to meet all these amazing people from history, and it's like this massive stage and these scenes that are just blow your mind. And I just love it because I also love history, and history is the ultimate storytelling. That's our past. That's where all history comes from. So all three of those combined are pretty awesome.
All right. What was the project that you work on? There's a lot of different mediums we've talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's motion.
Oh, absolutely.
There's print ads. Yep. There's actual like physical rides. Working at Disney, what was the thing that was the biggest learning curve?
Okay.
Out of those, because obviously you didn't come in and you're like, oh, I'm an expert at working on design.
Absolutely.
All these mediums.
No, absolutely. Well, you know what the funny thing is? One thing I've learned as a designer, the first part of that is, if I've never, when I used to come to the HOW conferences, everybody's like, oh, you're a graphic designer. I think graphic designer is actually kind of, it's too narrow. It's too pigeonholed for all of us here. We're designers. We're design thinkers. We execute in graphic design often. But I can tell you right now, I could grab most people here and put them on any project. They could use their design thinking to make it great, even if they're designing a ride vehicle, because it's design principles. Like, I went into a position, design merchandise three-dimensionally, when I came out of a print background in school as a graphic designer. All of it's you can apply it to anything. So on any project, I've always applied the design thing, and the biggest learning curve, I would have to say, was more process-based. About, you could design anything on paper, but getting it to its final product where it's actually out there is the most difficult part. So you could, you know, it's almost like if you take it back to print, you could design amazing, but if you're not press checking right and you're not checking your stocks and all, you know, all those details, that's where you can lose the magic of what you intended to create. So if you just design and pass it off and hope for the best as it goes out, that's where you lose the quality. On all my projects, that was my biggest epiphany, is follow it all the way through until it hits the floor and redo it and retest it and retry it and prod it and poke it until it's exactly how you want, the best you can until it's due. The best project I've worked on and the one I've learned the most or probably the most exciting, it's really tough. Pirates of the Caribbean was amazing when I was working on that.
Which part of Pirates of the Caribbean? Was it the movie launch?
We were doing kind of franchise work around it in sync with the movie before it was launched. So the main reason it was so amazing is I kept, you know, back then I was living in Orlando, but they would take me out to the studios and I got to walk the sets of the movie. And I was just like, because it's hot, you know, it's in the Disney studios where Walt shot all the stuff, and you're sitting there and you're like, I'm on, you know, the Black Pearl. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I turn to my friend, and this is when they're shooting part two and three.
We think it's cool because Ben's got the Black Pearl Lego ship above.
Awesome, very cool. Yeah.
But you're actually on the Black Pearl.
On the Black Pearl, man. Wow. And I was talking to the artists working on it. I love set designers and production designers and guys who make props. So I talked to those guys for like hours. So that was really cool. The neatest thing recently I did that was kind of semi-pinnacle and just awesome was I got to work with the Muppets. And we've got this, you know, we announced the next movie that's going to be coming out, which is
really
exciting.
What's Kermit like in
person? Very green.
Wait, there's another one coming out?
Yeah, that's the plan. So the cool thing about working with the Muppets was just, you know, it was a childhood dream. I mean, I grew up on the Muppets, and it was just so cool. And I got to meet, you know, like Pepe. Him and I had a conversation. We were hanging out.
Pepe,
and so it was just really great to be able to do something like that and work with all these different, people that have just amazing imaginations and creativity. And really develop some amazing stuff. Like, a couple of the guys had worked with Lucas on Yoda puppets. One of the guys, if you ever remember the show Dinosaurs we had on ABC,
I remember that.
Developed the costumes. One of them, you know, I mean, it's just like, it was awesome. We were talking about, you know, all the different movies and that the Muppets had done, from, you know, Manhattan to working with Gonzo, and, you know, just really, really cool stuff. And they were telling me stories about Jim Henson, and he was a huge idol of mine. So that was definitely one of those like pinch your arm moments where you're just sitting there and you're like, here I am at, you know, at the Disney Studios working on and with the Muppets. What is going on? Like, are you dreaming right now? Because you have to stop to enjoy it and savor it. And it was just, I couldn't have been more like beaming that day. I mean, it's just, I still today when I talk about it, it just gets me excited.
Yeah, he's definitely beaming right now. Yeah. Wouldn't you say? He's got that glow.
But I can see that because you're also probably like, wait a minute. You pull out the Pantone swatch book and you're trying to see if Kermit is proper.
No, there you go. That's the truth, man. Well, here's the thing. Even though it's great there, I mean, any creative or anybody working in any field, you always have your good and bad days. The thing is, do you surround yourself with the people that help you through those? There's people who are assisters and there's people who are resistors. You want to find the people that are going to actually help and are collaborative and look for solutions. They don't only look for problems. It's important sometimes to look for problems and while you're problem solving, and let's see what the issue is here. This is working, and find all the things that are wrong. And here's the areas of opportunity. And there's also what's great about it. And then take all the areas of opportunity and turn them into great. So you're basically shooting holes in the armor of the idea or the project to patch it up so it's more bulletproof, right? But if you have people that are always just naysayers and can't, a waste of your time. You can tell them that you're like, hey, look, we're trying to do this. I need to be, looking for solutions right now. But surround yourself with those people that can get to the solution. The best example, if you've ever seen Apollo 13, there's a part where the oxygen is getting oversaturated with, I think, carbon dioxide, and the filter's not working. So Ed Harris down at, Mission Control, they know what they have in the ship. They get like 12 engineers in a room. They put all those things in a box, dump it on the table down to like their socks and like coils and pencils and, pieces of paper. And they dump it on. They go, this is what they have. Make the filter. And he goes, don't give me problems, people. Give me solutions, because they don't have a lot of time to do this. And those guys made it happen. And they also made a list of how they could build it back up there. I mean, these guys are up in space, and they figured out not only how to build that thing, but give them a step-by-step so they could replicate what they did down there. And these are people's lives. They're not trying to just solve the next print campaign for a product, right? Mm-hmm. These are people's lives, and they did under pressure because they looked for solutions. They didn't only look for problems. If there's a problem, what's the solution to it? And you'll notice Walt was amazing at that. He hated the word can't. I got to have dinner with a guy, Richard Sherman, who wrote like all the Mary Poppins music, and was the Sherman brothers wrote all the music for Walt for many other movies. And I asked him, I like, tell me about Walt. One thing that stood out, I'll never forget this. He goes, Walt hated the word can't. He wanted to find solutions. And if it doesn't work, I mean, people are willing to admit that, but it's like, why slow down the process by saying can't do this. Legal won't let us do this. We don't have the money for that. It's like, let's find solutions. So if there's an issue where we lost the budget and half of it's gone, okay, now what do we do? What's the solution? Not, let's give up.
Yeah, a lot of people get stuck there.
Yes, absolutely.
And use it as an excuse.
Think about how many times you've been on projects where people have killed ideas or projects just because they couldn't see the future. You got to be a visionary in order to be successful in any project, in any design.
And adapt.
Adapting is huge. Absolutely. Things change consistently. And you need to be able to adapt to your situation to make it work. So
that is fantastic advice. Well, we're going to take one final break, and we're going to come back with a little game of pass the question, as it would be. And you say you have your good days, which are hanging with the Muppets, and your bad days are what, being attacked by pirates?
I would have to say probably being attacked by legal. No, I'm just kidding.
We are back with Christopher Chapman, and we have a couple questions for you from our last guest.
Our last guest, actually, Denise Korn, runs basically a youth mentoring program, and she brought in one of her students that just graduated high school, and he's here.
That's cool.
And so because of this program, I think it helped him. He is now the first kid in his family to graduate from high school.
How phenomenal is that?
And the first one to college. I was just amazed. I walked her back to the room and came back here, and I was like, she actually did this.
That's powerful.
She did this 10 years ago. She's been just helping kids.
Yeah.
And helping our profession. All right, so the first one comes from Denise.
Yeah, and Denise was talking about how her daughter specifically is really into Disney movies and into the whole fairy tale mindset, kind of a Disney princess girl. And so what Denise is wondering, as she lives in the world of reality, not everything is a happy ending and whatnot, she was saying, how do you keep reinventing the happy ending?
I can speak for myself and what I've learned from everybody at the company and learned from you know, John Lasseter and, you know, the guys at Pixar and all the storytellers and animators and
movie
makers. Yeah, I actually got to present to him at a meeting once, which was awesome, and talk with him for a bit. And funny enough, he took some art that I created and, you know, swapped it out for some stuff that he had with him, which was awesome. I was like, this is amazing. So I hope he has it in his office somewhere or something like that. But anyway.
He's pee my pants.
Yeah, trust me. Like, he's one of my biggest idols. Yeah. But, you know, when it comes down to it, was reinventing the happy ending, was that it, or keeping it going?
Well, you have to basically, I think she means that it's like, you have to have every movie has a different happy ending.
Oh yeah, okay, so here's the deal. Happy endings are best served when people, one, they can relate, right? There's some relating. Nobody likes to watch a movie and they're like, halfway through, all of a sudden you're like, I know how this is going to end. Right? Nobody likes that.
Right.
Because then there's no surprise, even if it's good or if it's bad. Happy endings can take different meanings because sometimes it's the hero achieving something. Sometimes it's them losing something that might seem like, wait, that's a sad ending, but in reality, they gained a whole new perspective on life. That might be the happy ending. The traditional happy ending, which when Walt took the fairy tale Snow White, it was already written, so he couldn't change the ending. The ending was the prince kisses her, she wakes up, all's fine. You know, the witch is gone. And that's that very kind of, now it has become almost cliche, traditional, the guy gets the girl type of thing, you know. What we've started to do is, that you'll see, is like, it's the unexpected. It's driven by motivation. The characters are believable. I mean, these are pixels, or they're pencil on paper, right, colored in, that you're starting to care about. I mean, I remember watching WALL-E and being like, I've never cared. Not only is he CGI, he's also a piece of metal that I think is probably one of the warmest, most heartfelt characters I've ever seen in movies.
And he doesn't even talk. Really,
exactly, you know? Right?
And he's in a future world.
Exactly, like relatable. Yeah. How can you relate a robot? But you could relate to him because you watched the way he interacted with Eve.
Brilliant.
He wanted to find love. He wanted to find somebody he could connect with because he was so alone. It's like when you watch that, no matter what happened as it went along and you see the evolution of that movie, the ending is, you know, can be sad and happy at the same time. And it ends up pulling together this thing. So whenever you're reinventing, you never really chase the ending. You're really just trying to tell a great story that you understand the motivation of the characters. And one thing I know Walt's Nine Old Men told all these people in Pixar and Lasseter talks about this, for every laugh there is in a movie, there should be a tear. Because you want to tug at the heartstrings. You want people to relate emotionally to these characters. You know, villains?
Which, by the way, the first 7 minutes of Up did amazing.
Oh, can you? Yeah, absolutely. That part where it's all silent, the montage about Ellie.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I cried.
So, yeah, how sad was that?
Totally
right?
Cried.
But immediately, you felt the heart of the movie, right? Now you cared about the outcome.
Oh, I invested so much.
And he was a little curmudgeon, too.
Yeah, if you don't care about the outcome of a character's growth, mm-hmm. progression, or, you know, the way they're going to fall apart, it doesn't matter. Same goes to villains, though. If there's a villain and they're just angry and mean, they're so one-dimensional. But when you care and you can understand where the villain came from, mm-hmm. it changes a lot. I mean, think about Star Wars, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking about Boba Fett right now.
Yeah, there you go,
and,
yeah.
And I have the Boba Fett, Bad Pete dressed as Boba Fett.
Yes, absolutely, we did that in our group, yeah.
Okay,
I think my friend Mike Sullivan worked on that.
Really?
Yeah, I had my good friend Chris Kelly, who was going to Disneyland. He's like, hey, want anything brought back? And I was like, there's one thing I brought
did
back.
Did you get it?
Yeah.
Oh, glad, man. Isn't that a killer's toy? I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I care both about Bad Pete and Boba Fett.
But you know what? In all honesty, you kind of can. You can understand where they came from. You remember his background. And if you understand, you know, the whole thing with his father and, like, how he became this bounty hunter thing. And you look at, like, for example, Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. After I kind of knew the pre-story a little bit, but after you see 1, 2, and 3, I know some people hate those movies, but
sure.
Understanding his motivation and what happened to him and his loss made 4, 5, and 6 so different. Like, you go back and watch it, you're still kind of scared, but you're kind of like...
One, two, and three. Did they make those movies?
But you know, here's the other example. Have you ever seen the movie, one of my favorite villains of all time, Gangs of New York, Martin Scorsese?
I've not seen it. Actually.
Get a chance to see it.
Neither of us seen that.
Bill the Butcher, Daniel Day-Lewis plays him, and
big mustache.
He is ruthlessly evil, but you understand his motivation and why he's the way he is. And while you understand and have compassion for why, you still hate him, but his evil makes sense, right?
Mm.
So going back to the whole, you know, putting the cap on it, reinventing the happy ending, you're never reinventing just the happy ending. The happy ending is taking people through a journey where they're both having highs and lows and they care about the characters, and whatever the outcome becomes the ending. Even sometimes when it isn't gleefully happy, again, that underlying piece, you know, was there, did somebody evolve as a human being? They might have had loss at the end that seems sad, but they got better, or maybe somebody did get triumph. I remember Incredibles, while it seemed like, you know, a happy ending, my favorite moment in that movie was where this big, strong, tough guy, Mr. Incredible, his wife is so mad at him, and he finally, you know, breaks down. She's like, why are you this way? Why are you this way? And he's acting all, he goes, and he puts his head down, he goes, I'm not strong enough. And she's like, what? He goes, I'm not strong enough. I can't lose you. Like, he didn't want them to fight with her, with him, because he didn't want to lose his wife and kids. He's like, I can't lose you. I'm not strong enough to not have you in my life. That moment, he was like, everybody's like, in your heart, right?
Right.
All of a sudden, you're like, I can relate to him. I have a family, or anybody's had somebody they cared about, whether it be a dog or a brother, mm-hmm. sister, mom and dad, or a child. And that transformation of seeing him do that, the end encapsulated in them fighting this bad villain and kind of collecting together, and it became happy. But you followed them through that journey. Had you not, and that ending still happened, would it have been happy, or would it have just been cliche? The real ending was that moment right there. And then they capsule it off to see them come together. But that was the ending, right? And it was so cool because he came to the culmination of admitting that he, even though he's this big, strong block on the outside, deep down inside, he's emotional, soft, and has vulnerability. Nobody can, he's the strongest guy in the world, but he's still vulnerable, right? Mm. And that was the journey. That was the end for me, and the rest was just the payoff. So isn't that cool?
I mean, that is cool. So that, you're a good storyteller,
that's
Chris.
That's how we tell stories.
What's your favorite Disney movie?
I have two. You know, it's hard for me to make decisions. Is that terrible? As a designer, like, you have to pick one logo, right? So the number one visually would be Sleeping Beauty. My favorite painter of all time, Ivan Earle, painted all those backdrops inspired by tapestries, medieval tapestries, added black to them to give a deeper color, similar to the tapestries. You can put that movie on mute and watch it, and every frame is like a master painting. Beautiful. But Peter Pan is up there because I grew up on that, just like, That's Disney magic and fantasy and storytelling at its best. I mean, we're talking pirates, Indians, flying. Yeah. I mean, like, all of that was just like, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better combination for a great kid. Humor, yeah, just great, like, lines. Fantasy, and you're like, it was just so amazing. I always wanted to fly. I mean, who doesn't want to fly? So that was cool. That's definitely up there. Recently, moving forward, there's too many to pick from that are so close.
I mean, all right, so other than the obvious, which is Hot Tub Time Machine, what is your favorite non-Disney movie?
Oh, that's tough. There's so many, but I would say there's especially within storytelling, Goonies is way up there. Way up there.
Goonies is getting too much airtime.
Goonies is good. There's a movie called Secondhand Lion.
Ben, you're too young. We're at the generation.
Yeah, the 80s. Anything from the 80s, man, it's tough to argue with.
We saw the Goonies at the age that it was released for.
Yes.
You saw it like later.
Very true,
you know,
very true.
As an adult.
If you get a chance, Secondhand Lions is one of my favorite movies.
I love that movie.
It's so brilliantly done. It's some of the best storytelling. I highly recommend that. But overarching above it all, again, here's an example of, like, you asked me for one, I'm giving you like four. Indiana Jones, right, is just
heard of it.
Amazing to me.
The first one?
Yeah, the first and the third.
Yeah.
Okay. Second one's
I've
never seen the second.
I enjoy it for its reasons, but the third is just like, to me, like, it's just like.
See, I rate them in the order that they came out.
One, two, three.
Four.
I go one, two, three.
And
mine's 1, 3, 2.
Was there another one?
Oh, they didn't make
one,
a fourth.
Two, three,
they're supposed
ten?
To make a fourth.
1, 2, 3, and 30?
But so then the only last thing to that is Braveheart. I mean, that combines everything I love, history, Scotland storytelling, you know.
I knew Scotland was going to.
And think about this. You know, you think about Braveheart kind of had a happy ending, but also had an incredibly sad ending because he was the martyr, right?
Yeah.
But I love that. I just love that movie. I think it's so brilliantly told.
So powerful, too. I mean, like, his wife, you know, dying.
Yeah, and just, like, sacrifice. And but the funny thing is, he was based on a myth and a legend, a story. You know, you're trying to see a little bit behind it. But, you know, my favorite part of that goes back to storytelling is you see when the myth is starting to pass throughout Scotland, and they're like, oh, I heard he took on 500 men by himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I heard he's 10 feet tall. And he even makes a joke in the movie about, like, you know, yeah, you're not William Wallace. He's like, yeah, sure, if William Wallace was here, and he's talking about himself, he's like, he'd consume him with, you know, fireballs of ice and lightning out of his arse. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's really cool to see the mythology progress and the way they even address it in the movie. So.
Okay. And the other question, we actually had we gave Joseph your card and said – Disney destination. So
yeah.
I think his question deals more with assuming the hospitality aspect.
Absolutely, yeah.
What was
so he wanted to know if you guys just played Disney movies in all the hotel rooms and stuff.
No, you know, it's funny. Like, when you go for hospitality, like, we're global leaders in hospitality, and we always put the guest first. And so, like, if you've ever been to the parks, you'll see, like, everything is you're a guest. That's what we call them, guests. We don't call them consumers when they're at our parks. We don't call them, you know, clients. They are our guests.
Loiterers.
Yes, yeah, exactly. As if they're our hosts, and Looters. We treat them like that way. But when it comes down to it, all of our stuff that's destination based is we try to make you feel like you're incredibly welcome, and it's driven by that. Inside the rooms, there's informational things to help people to understand the parks better so they can plan their day. We have like nighttime channels, so you have a character actually tell nighttime bed stories to the kids by reading books like on the screen.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. There's like weather, so people know what the weather's gonna be like that day, permanently up there for that exact location. Little things like that, they're absolutely brilliant. And even like some things that'll be informational slide type stuff. And of course, all the other stations you can get, like any hotel. But things just to help them do some of the planning and figure things out for their day, which is pretty cool.
Chris, I've never gone to any kind of Disneyland thing, and I've never thought I'd be interested.
Oh, you have to, man.
I just always thought that's just dumb, cliche.
No, dude, I'm telling you, you gotta go.
I totally want to go. Dude,
my recommendation would be either to pick. To go to Disneyland with all the new stuff with California Adventure, Disney California Adventure, or if you went to Walt Disney World, the place is like, I might be off by a little bit, but it's larger than the island of Manhattan.
Wow.
I mean, it is massive. And there's four massive parks. We've got two water parks, Blizzard Beach and Typhoon Lagoon. And it's just downtown Disney.
You can't do this in one day, though, can you? Oh, no. I mean, how long
do
you
recommend? Recommendation, if you really want to do it right, is to go, if you can, to go at least for a 3-day weekend, but to really do it right, you need to go for about 5 to 7 days. But ultimately, if you got a chance and you went down and you at least did a weekend and hit like Magic Kingdom, Epcot, and one other park, if you can do all four, awesome. We have these things called park hoppers where you can like one ticket price. Well, yeah. You can go to any park that day.
Wow.
I'm telling you, you'd be shocked. Most people, like, they have this perception of what a theme park could be until they go to Disney and they think like, you know, Six Flags, right?
Exactly.
You go to this, it's you're going to be taken through stories, even in the land that you're in, down to like what way people address you and the clothing they're wearing. And it's all about like getting you in this willing suspension of disbelief. And it's amazing.
Good salesman.
I love it.
Man, I want to go back again. I haven't
let's
been
go
once.
Together.
I'm telling you guys.
Isn't there a Disneyland?
We'll take the
somewhere.
Long trip back from Boston.
Yes.
Kind of on the way back to home.
All right. So our next guests are we have Diana Valentine and
Jim Krause.
Jim Krause coming on the show. What are
I
your
saw
questions?
Their talk. It was wonderful, by the way.
Yeah, what are your questions for them?
What are my questions for them? I would have to say what I'd love to know. Funny enough is she doesn't live far from me, and we've been trying to get together. She lives on the west side. I live on the east side of Los Angeles, and we keep saying she's like...
Rival gangs.
And I keep west side, east siders. My biggest recommendation would be I always like to know where people's inspiration pre-high school comes from. You find a lot of people very influenced by the age of 12. So if they can either transport them back to the age of 12, what inspired them, and they can look back and they realize, oh my gosh, that affected my passion today. And their passion doesn't have to necessarily be exactly what they're doing as a career. It might be one project that they're passionate about. Like, I love 1930s and 40s and Art Deco and all that and the history from back then. So a lot of stuff, whenever I do it, I'm really excited when I work on projects that have to be inspired from that era. But yeah, anything from when they're 12 or from childhood for that matter that really just lights them on fire, what is it?
She's going to love that question.
And anything for Jim?
Ask him the same thing. I'd like to hear both of their sides. It's too, it'd be neat, especially because, you know, female, male, two different, you know, personalities, and I think that'd be phenomenal to hear, you know, what their, if they could go back to their 12-year-old self, looking back and seeing what affected them at that age, whether it be movies or things they did that they then brought to their adult.
I like it. I mean, that touches on so many things. We could do a whole show just on that question.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should start the talk on that.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for being on your show.
No, thanks, God.
If you guys have any comments, questions, 36point.com, drop us your favorite Disney movie or your favorite non-Disney movie other than Hot Tub Time Machine, because that is the obvious. We'll be back in a week or so with our next guests.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, guys, thanks.